Welcome to Cinema Sleuths. I'm Adam Cook.
I'm Irrational Marzadeh.
Els Potter.
Kurt Walker.
I'm Irrational Marzadeh.
Yes, you are. And we're sitting here together drinking some tea and...
Coffee.
Yeah, don't try and speak for what I'm drinking.
What are you drinking?
Yeah, what are you drinking?
A little coffee. You're right.
You're completely correct. All right, so we're just sort of doing an impromptu episode once again.
Always.
We've been trying to do a formal one, but...
Osama's dead!
Woo! Osama died since the last Cinema Sleuths episode.
What happened since the last Cinema Sleuths episode?
In cinema or in the world?
In the world.
I think Osama died.
Osama died, Obama ripped on Trump.
Yeah, the Phoenix of America rose from the ashes.
And Brian De Palma's underway production for Redacted 2.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Is that
movie.
A joke?
Maybe.
Well, actually, Brian De Palma's blowout has been rediscovered by the masses.
By the masses, because it came out on Criterion, right?
It came out on Criterion, yes.
Yeah, and everyone's like, oh my god, I gotta see this movie. I'm gonna give it 5 stars on Mubi. And they're just loving it.
Is that, yeah, that's me. I did
that.
I think
Adam Cook really started the train of the blowout train.
Yeah, so it was released in 1981, but I watched it last night.
So. I was really shocked because when I saw that post, I was like, I thought it said blow at first, 5 out of 5.
Oh, that's like one of the worst movies.
Yeah,
ever.
I was almost like gagging.
Why is Penelope Cruz in acting?
Yeah.
I'm just wondering.
Penelope Cruz is amazing.
I actually,
what are you talking about?
You know what? His complaint's understandable. Penelope Cruz has been awful in a lot of stuff.
Okay, so you've only seen her like American movies then?
Oh, I'm
when
sorry.
When she's in her natural setting, dude, Penelope
yeah.
Cruz is like charismatic,
ass, yeah.
Warm,
it isn't,
motherly,
it,
80
she's also,
pounds.
She's in that remake with Tom Cruise,
Vanilla Sky.
Vanilla Sky, she's good in that.
Is she?
Yeah,
I have not.
That's Cameron Crowe, isn't it?
Yeah. He's kind of out of his terrain there.
So, what are we going to talk about, ladies?
Let's talk about Penelope Cruz since it came out.
I actually haven't seen really any Almodovar except for
Broken Embraces.
Broken Embraces, which she's good in.
Yeah, she's really good.
Sucks.
What about Tom Cruise since we brought him up?
Yeah, let's just
how
talk
you
about
guys
Tom
feel,
Cruise.
Tom how
Cruise?
Do you guys feel about Mission Impossible 4? Because I'm sure you all love Mission Impossible 1.
This is just heading to Brian
and
De Palma.
I am one of the few who really liked Mission Impossible 3. J.J. Abrams is a very frantic scriptwriter, and you can tell that it's lacking emotion and tries to force it. But I think any movie that's emotional climax is a dude getting his heart shocked to stop beating and then resuscitated. I'm game for that.
That's a lot of movies, man.
He made a good Star Trek. I will
yeah,
be the first one to defend
good.
It.
Yeah. That was okay.
I haven't seen
it's
any
okay.
of the films that we're talking about. I haven't seen any of J.J. Abrams' canon.
I'm going to see Super 8. Super 8 looks
yeah, it looks decent.
I'll see
a
Super 8
throwback.
Yeah, it has it's a modern Hollywood film with like a color palette.
And tracking shots that look actually well thought out. There's some scenes where it's tracking there, and I'm like, almost every scene looks like he uses a tracking shot
mm-hmm.
instead of like the typical J.J. Abrams handy cam
yeah.
over the shoulder.
Yeah, because like Star Trek, even though it's got like cool things going on color-wise, like it's just TV.
Yeah,
like,
and how do you do a tracking shot of a giant like fictitious landscape, you know
yeah,
what
yeah.
I mean? He could have done it in a much more.
I love what he does with that is it Rage Against the Machine or Beastie Boys opens up with the chase scene with the boy.
Oh yeah, that's Beastie Boys.
Beastie Boys, okay.
Yeah, what's this?
That's the opening of Star Trek.
Yeah.
Oh really?
The kid steals
it does
the car.
Something really unique with the mm-hmm. song that
which song?
Really
I can't stand it.
Yeah.
Oh, I love
and
that
he's
song.
A 9-year-old boy. Just
sabotage.
Like, away.
Yeah,
sabotage.
And for Star Trek, for getting people involved in a universe
I'm
that they don't really care about,
yeah.
that scene at the beginning of Star Trek was ripped from Lost. They use this Lost score. It's something really sad happening to a dude who's losing his wife. Yeah, it brings. I remember I was almost tearing up in the beginning. I was like, it's so studio, but so hard to deny the like. How crafted it is at getting you addicted to it right away.
But it's too bad they had like such a like exposition driven twist in the end.
Exactly, and they
like,
brought in the old Spock and
yeah.
stuff, which I
still like, it's like a freewheeling movie until that point.
I will admit, you guys are going to be shocked. I'm a huge Stargate and Star Trek fan,
yeah.
so when I saw the canon of Spock, like I've still gone back in my notes and tried to figure out how the fuck is Spock alive? I Wrath of Khan, he dies, and then I believe they bring him back and he dies again.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe he's alive at that point. And
you're gonna leave us behind here. I've never seen. Star
yeah,
Trek.
I'm a really
yeah,
guys.
Yeah.
Anyone who's listening, Deep Space Nine. If you're gonna invest in a Star Trek, whew, that's some good shit.
Yeah. Also, anyone listening, Ellis Potter is new to this podcast. He's an actor, director, musician, comic book writer.
Troubadour.
Something of a renaissance.
Conquistador.
Man. He's huge on the Vancouver porn scene.
Yes.
Huge.
And by
but huge, not girth huge.
No.
No, just popularity.
He actually has the niche market small dick.
Yes, exactly.
But he's huge.
Yeah. It was,
let's
it
talk about
niche.
That for a second.
Oh,
small
yeah.
dick porn.
Yeah, well, my
oh,
first,
boy.
My first
friend of Palma. Friend of Palma.
Let's
I really want to talk about 2 inches below average. That's a really good indie porn film I was in right to begin with. All right, so Brian De Palma.
So, Adam, I think you recently saw Scarface for the first time.
I saw Scarface because I was really excited about watching Blow Up, and then I couldn't watch Blow Up for a certain reason, and so I watched Scarface, which was not a great movie.
Yeah.
But I dug it. It's fun at times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's...
You know what? There's... Sorry.
Yeah, yeah, no.
There's one shot in there that we didn't talk about before that I'll bring up now because
yeah.
it's just perfection. It's when when Tony Montana is in the apartment in the first deal he's making.
The chainsaw?
Yeah,
with the chainsaw.
Yeah, yeah.
And the chainsaw... The guy has a chainsaw and he's, like, restrained or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Or his friend's restrained mm-hmm. in the bathroom. And then it... The camera pans to the window.
Oh, then it cuts out.
And then
it
cuts out and it continues on.
Yeah.
And then the layers of sound shift.
Yeah.
And this is like,
yeah.
you know,
and then
blow
it,
out.
It tracks down. It's on a crane.
Yeah, oh, and it comes all the way down
yeah.
to the two guys waiting in the
yeah.
car.
And isn't that great? Like, the compositions, like, match one another. Even though it's a cut, like, it's a 180-degree cut where we switch to the other side of the surface of the exterior.
Yes.
And it's pretty much like the same image, but
mm-hmm.
reflected. Like, no,
yeah, I don't think it's easy
to
do. I think Brian De Palma is actually really good at...
Well, he's obsessed with like the architecture of scenes, of just matching shots so that the scenes are like... Because I can almost recount like every shot in the opening of like Femme Fatale and stuff. It's
yeah.
just like...
Well, I find that he's able to connect spaces together.
Mm-hmm. No,
in really interesting.
I really feel he really succeeds in making Scarface feel.
Wait, what have you seen?
Scarface. It's a very untrustworthy universe, and the characters themselves, like, that's one of the few films where I watch it and I feel like dirty when I'm watching it. I feel like I just don't feel right being in that universe. Like, it really gives you, even the lead, it gives you someone that's very hard to grip onto and look at his ideals, and you're almost forced to believe it. And I think it has one of the greatest sticking to your guns moments, like completely literal at the end, where a faceless dude is the one who eventually is Tony Montana's downfall with a shotgun in the back.
I don't like
horrifying.
How that character's
you don't
like
it.
Composed though. Like, he's like this.
He looks like the fucking Terminator.
He looks
yeah,
like death,
just
man.
Like,
I don't know. I think
it should just be like a goon.
But that doesn't
does
the shot not pull out and then pan over and he walks right into the crowd of other goons and looks completely
no
in
he
place.
Does because how he's photographed it separates him from the rest.
Okay, I agree. But
I actually thought of, believe it or not, Public Enemies during that moment
yeah.
because the guy who actually kills John Dillinger
mm-hmm.
is so cool and composed and calm
yeah,
and whatnot and
yeah.
this guy like kind of reminded me of that
yeah, yeah,
where he's
yeah.
the one who gets him is the one who's just like. Focused,
mm-hmm.
but it's a very different context.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know. I think the Oliver Stone script is many times at odds.
Oliver Stone.
Oh, they're at odds. They're really at odds.
Public
that shouldn't have been its downfall, though.
Scarface.
That shouldn't have been its
written
downfall.
By Oliver Stone.
No.
That can
yeah.
work.
Yeah.
Jesus
very written,
Christ.
Like all of his movies.
Yeah.
Because,
man.
But
can I just get a big fuck you, Oliver Stone? Like,
hey. Defender Whoa. Of JFK and Natural Born Killers.
Yeah.
Can I get a big fuck you, Oliver Stone? I don't like the guy.
Yeah,
I really don't like his persona in any interview I've seen.
Hey,
just...
man, he's on the Taxi Driver special features.
Yeah.
And he's really nice.
Yeah, bro, have you... No. I just want to ask you...
He's got pimp mustache.
Wait, Kurt, shut up.
Yeah.
Have you seen Wall Street 2?
Yeah, masterpiece from what I've heard.
No, it's not even... Excuse me.
Yeah.
The word masterpiece doesn't even come close to what Wall Street 2. All right?
I think, yeah.
Good
or
bad.
No, this is what, we're in limbo right now.
Did you actually see it?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I've heard Defenders. Like,
yeah.
No, Shia LaBeouf is one of the worst actors I've ever seen. Like,
he's a pretty cool guy.
No,
Shia LaBeouf
would
be used, right?
But I think he's way out of line calling, because he like called Spielberg on Kingdom of Crystal Skull. I hate when actors do that, like Colin Farrell's Miami Vice and
the
stuff.
The thing is, it's like, if you actually look at his performances, if you look at like, all the early TV crap that he did with, like, Even Stevens, if you guys remember that stupid show.
I'll be straight up honest, just really quick.
Yeah.
Thing. I like Even Stevens.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, so what he does is he has the same character that's the stuttering, yammering, the guy just goes like, no,
because that's what he's cast it as.
Yeah, he actually plays that very same character in one episode of Freaks and Geeks. Well, he has like a really small one.
All right, now can we have a little golf clap for Freaks and Geeks right now?
Yeah, Freaks and Geeks. Oh. Well done.
I haven't seen it, so.
Should be clapping.
I didn't know that you guys were Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah.
Dude, I don't give a damn about no bad reputation.
Yeah. One of the great opening title sequences.
Yeah, it's phenomenal, and it really sums up the teenage condition, because how many times you've been in that shitty gymnasium getting your photographs.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. It's you know, and also with Freaks and Geeks, it was canceled after one season, but it's one of those rare instances where it actually doesn't matter.
Yes.
In one season, it has a beginning, middle, end. Mm-hmm. It gets everything done.
It almost does in the first episode. That's the crazy thing. That's
the first
episode's
gone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I love that Jason Segel, instead of playing the big teddy bear who you want to root for, plays the creep that I almost wanted to leave every single scene, man.
Oh, interesting. I really like his character.
I was a Lindsay and a James Franco characters, whatever, what is his name?
I don't remember.
Yeah, and I was a huge shipper of them. And Jason Segel was just the needle. The needle that was digging into.
He's actually hard. He's even more difficult and undeclared. But the thing with Freaks and Geeks is he's a well-rounded character, and undeclared, he's like a cartoonish.
Yeah, he's understandable in Freaks and Geeks. I feel bad for him, but he's also playing a character that I've never seen Jason Segel play, nor will he probably ever get cast in again in his life.
Yeah.
Because he very much wears a smile these days, and is like the father figure, and is like always the wise one, like on How I Met Your Mother, and even when he's not wise, and like such as Forgetting Sarah Marshall, he's still the goofy teddy bear that you have
but
to root
for.
But
he's hilarious and Knocked Up, where he is actually kind of creepy.
He's a sleazeball.
Yeah.
But that sleazeball I loved, because that guy, I believe, is, he believes that he's going to pull dirty shit through the film Knocked Up, and then he actually comes around and is a well-rounded character. I believe he gives a monologue or something to Seth Rogen.
I can't remember what happened to those characters.
I really like how the friends are handled in that movie.
I do too. Very realistic portrayal. So Arash, you clearly want to say something. Do you like any Judd Apatow features?
You talk Apatow.
This will be interesting.
They seem right up your alley for just constantly talking shit. You know what I mean?
Okay. Arash.
Yeah.
Are you fond of Judd Apatow's films? Let's keep it to the ones he's directed rather than the ones
he's directed Knocked Up.
40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, and Funny People.
And Funny People.
Yeah.
Funny People, I thought, you know, was probably my favorite out of those two. 40-Year-Old Virgin was like, eh. And,
it's his funniest.
It is his funniest, but I just didn't. I was like, okay, it's Steve Carell kind of playing Steve Carell. Didn't feel any kind of connection toward it, but
we'll see.
The thing I loved about Funny People was I felt like, because of the use of a lot of Adam Sandler's original footage and all of his original stuff, right?
Yeah.
We go through the point of him kind of selling out to what selling out is, you know, of him playing like Merman and whatever.
Yeah.
And him waking up every morning being like, I'm alone and this and that, where it has to take to a point where he thinks he's sick to actually, you know, it's that cliche where it's like, I'm dying. Kind of like in Magnolia was the recent movie I saw that used that. You know, it's like, I'm dying, you know, please. I don't have much time left. And he goes around and he does that. I thought it was really fitting. It was one of those movies that I wish Adam Sandler just quit at, you know? If he just were to do that film and then just do producing and stuff like that from then on. But sadly, that is not the case.
I don't know. I could actually see Adam Sandler being used again by Apatow in a supporting role in a more anti-Adam Sandler way eventually. Because they have a really interesting relationship together. They're roommates before
mm-hmm.
either of them were famous. That's where that footage comes from.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was going to say about 40-Year-Old Virgin, I remember seeing it when it came out in theaters. And I think I had to sneak in because I was under 18 at the time. And I remember it being the funniest movie I had seen in a long time. And it was, you know, we had just gone through Deuce Bigelow, the two Deuce Bigelow movies. You know,
holy crap.
And stuff like that. And comedy really started to feel... When 40-Year-Old Virgin came out, it was a big deal.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have comedies like that at
American
that point. Now we have quite a few.
Yeah.
So I think 40-Year-Old Virgin at the time seemed great. I don't think it's a great film.
No.
But it's, like you said, it doesn't have the emotional dynamic.
Catherine Keener's awesome in it.
Catherine Keener's
one of those
characters.
One of those actors that you just like, I can't hate her. Mm-hmm. You know, there's only, like, for example, there's only a few kind of female actresses that can make me laugh. Like, Catherine O'Hara just makes me shit my pants. And then you have Tina Fey, who I think is just freaking brilliant, right? And it's just, yeah, Catherine Keener's just this, you know, you look at her in Synecdoche when she just has that kind of brief, you know, mom character for mm-hmm. a little while. She doesn't do anything different. But that's kind of the amazing part. Is
so you find her funny?
Yeah, I find her funny, and I find her really, like, to the point where she's not trying, and she's not obviously a funny person, mm-hmm. but it's like she understands what comedy is for a serious actor.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine her, I can't picture her in any funny roles, though. Like,
no, but I mean, I think what Arash is saying is that when you put her in the context of The Fortunate Virgin, which is otherwise a very silly movie, she's going to give a serious performance that complements the comedy yeah. movie. She knows her place within that film, mm-hmm. and it gives it like this actually really strong bearing. Mm-hmm. So I kind of agree with you. I think.
Yeah.
But I do hate her in Being John Malkovich, like in a good way.
Being John Malkovich.
She's such a bitch.
Yeah, she bothers a lot of that movie.
I've never finished that film.
Yeah. I don't like it.
I've seen it twice, both times. Can I make it a little bit further? But then I just can't finish it.
Speaking of not finishing films, the fucking Aviator.
Did you not finish it, Arash?
Yeah, you know, I knew you didn't finish it because you like posted one. You posted the photo on Facebook.
I couldn't watch it anymore.
Yeah, it's too bad. Because the last minutes.
It was hard to make
through.
No, but the thing is, the last few minutes are like.
Are the last few minutes worth me sitting through?
No, because the last few minutes, he starts saying the what's the line he keeps repeating.
I don't remember.
I don't know. He keeps repeating this one line, which is either suggesting that some social political theme mm-hmm. that the movie hasn't fully developed, mm-hmm. and or another theme. So it like rests in between, but neither of them are developed. So it really doesn't do much. Like, and I think Scorsese is like completely aware that movie's like.
Yeah, I bet, you know, in his private
quarters.
It's
shot so impersonally, except for some scenes. Yeah. Like, the despair scenes when he's in the screening room.
No,
and, you know, he's the cinema light right behind him. He's got Scorsese's beard.
Yeah.
And, you know, the pee cups, like, lining the room.
Don't
like,
you love it how that film got 5 Academy Award nominations, though?
Yeah, just arbitrary.
Yeah, arbitrary.
And like, then people see it as, like, Scorsese trying to get an Oscar. Like, he cares.
Yeah, like yeah.
No, he doesn't. What the fuck?
Oh, my God.
Scorsese's, like, so, like, misunderstood. Like, I can't think of another fan base that has done more damage to a director's base ideas.
Well, because I think what people
just see these movies and just see, like, gangsters.
What about Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist?
Nick and Nora's Infinite
Playlist. Ever.
Suck my balls.
I remember you told me about that sex scene, and I saw that sex scene, and it's, like, one of the worst sex scenes, like,
I'm pretty sure it's a finger bang scene, if you want.
And it's actually pretty upsetting because you have Kat Dennings and you have Michael Cera.
Yeah.
And that huge potential.
Yeah, and the movie's kind of
that could be a hot porno right there.
It doesn't know what it's doing because it's
2 inches above average.
But I also probably have been there.
You've defeated me. The movie's like kind otherwise. Like it's really holds its characters in affection, even though it's
useless. And that has a finger bang.
Okay, so. I'm done.
Yeah, I don't know.
What is
mean,
wrong with me saying finger bang?
It's off screen, you don't know.
It's like 40 seconds.
Isn't that the great thing about
she
the cinema?
She specifically says
it's what we don't know.
They have their clothes on.
Do they? No. Doesn't
it
come back?
It pans back and they have their clothes on.
I think
his
hands
are
all
conspicuously under the covers, like, I just finger banged you.
What?
And then he maybe gives it a sniff to be like Kat Dennings.
I don't know. I watched this while I was having like cereal in the morning.
That's pretty gross ass.
Yes, Arash.
Finger banging the cereal.
Are we going to cut this entire finger bang thing?
I don't know. I mean, if it segues into something naturally, we'll keep it. If not, then we'll cut it.
Okay, guys, where are we going to go from here?
Well, we can segue from finger bang, finger banging,
to
finger fucking,
nice.
Into sex scenes in film.
Oh. Yeah. Do you think sometimes the actors just, like, bone?
Don't you love in Scott Pilgrim when you think they're going to have sex, but they don't?
When's that happen?
Remember? At the very beginning.
When they're hooking up for the
first
time?
When they're hooking up for the first time, and then Ramona's like, you know what, I've changed my mind. I don't want to have sex with you, Pilgrim.
Oh, yeah.
Some of us read the graphic novels.
And then
yeah,
Scott,
I saw that it was PG-13.
Scott is absolutely okay with it. He's like, you know what, that's fine. We can just do this. And there's, I haven't done this, whatever this is, for a long time. I can quote this movie.
Yeah, you're very emotionally connected. I feel you.
Yeah, it's his favorite movie, dude.
Raj is really trying to force it.
Of all time.
I tried to segue
yeah.
into sex scenes.
Mm-hmm. Yours is... What's yours?
Well, you were going to say something. I want to hear what you think my favorite film of all time is.
Yeah, you want something Dead Man.
Yeah, probably Dead Man. It's
yeah.
a great film.
Yeah.
But I don't know, man. It might... Somebody ripped me
yeah,
apart for it the other day. Like, somebody gave me shit for liking In Bruges. And I don't think I should
yeah.
like that movie, but I really do.
Hey, let's talk In Bruges a little bit.
Yeah.
I love In Bruges. I saw it when it came out.
It's
like
almost got... Okay, it's directed by a guy that made plays before. He knows
Martin
what he's McDonough. Doing. He knows what he's doing with dialogue, with cinematography. It
mm-hmm.
has some scenes that are almost like In the Mood for Love, where they use the same soundtrack over and over again to almost slow down scenes. I think it's a masterpiece. I love that it takes place over the course of 3 days. The character doesn't even change. I think it has one of the most accurate portrayals of drug use in a film that I've ever seen, ever. Because for those of us that haven't done anything hard in the audience, that is the exact, like, definition of it. You're friendly with everyone, you're fucked out of your mind, and yet you're ready to turn on a dime emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, the end is one of the greatest, like, sum-ups, because you think there's going to be this sprawling love story, and it comes down to him seeing his best friend hurl himself out of a tower
mm-hmm.
on what should be a great day. Beautiful woman.
It's really
Ralph Fiennes is amazing.
Oh, the three leads are
yeah,
fantastic.
And it's only like really a three character show. The chick just kind of keeps the Colin Farrell's character going. But I don't know. I think the film is a masterpiece.
You know, Martin McDonagh, he just had one of his plays, Pillow Man.
What is that?
Is
it's
that the new
play?
Play
yeah. by Martin McDonagh.
Yeah, I heard you.
My friend saw it. Apparently, it sucked, but the script was good. So, going back to In Bruges, I think, God, it's just this, I don't know, I have to get a bit more analytical about it, but, I fucking love that film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's
and awesome. I think it's, you know, one character that I love more than anything is Ralph Fiennes. And Ralph Fiennes' character is so calm and cool and collected and hilarious.
See,
like, when,
the, okay,
when,
I,
when,
I,
when,
I,
when they have, when he's, like, when he leaves a message, and then he, what's the, it's Colin Farrell, Ralph Fiennes, and...
Brendan Gleeson.
Yeah.
Brendan Gleeson.
Yeah. And he's reading the message that Ralph Fiennes' character left.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, well, I told you not to leave the fucking phone, and he left the fucking phone. What the fuck is wrong with you? Next time I fucking call, you better be at the fucking phone. I swear to fucking God, you better not be at the fucking pub doing... And it's just, his voice is just so calm, and it's so eerie, but it's so hilarious, because no, I don't think the film is taking itself too seriously. Until it dives into what's actually why they're there.
Yes, and it's also the reason why it's so strange and why it's so perfect and boppy, and he like almost gets into a fight with a fat dude outside of the staircase and stuff, and it just does that in one shot. Is a dude wandering through purgatory? That's how I've always looked at that.
Oh,
film.
Yeah, that's what it is.
In Bruges, the way I almost feel it is he never made it out of that church where he shot the kid. There was not a life for him after that. He maybe even turned the gun on himself. And Bruges, the place he hates more than anything, the place that he doesn't even know what it is his purgatory, and his best friend is his shepherd through it. Hence why Brendan Gleeson is the most enlightened of the group.
Right.
And then it really hits you with that end part where it's like, no, man, it's the Cowboy Bebop syndrome, where it's a movie about a guy who can't feel alive, just like Cowboy Bebop is that, because he thinks everything that's happened to him has no consequence and will only hurt him and is almost a dream. And at the end, he is near death, and just like Spike is in Cowboy Bebop, realizes that his life was real and it was worth staying alive for, but only realizes this on
his
deathbed.
And I really, really wished I wouldn't die.
Exactly.
I'm gonna die in fucking Bruges.
And whereas Spike's last words to his friends before leaving the Bebop is, it's like, I'm not going there to die, I'm going there to see if I was really awake. And it's just like a huge thing where it's like, How do you justify, like, if you hate yourself, how do you justify that you are leading a good life and you have good things? And the only way to do that is to put yourself into a point where you're losing all those things and you wish you could have them back. And that's what...
What I really like about Colin Farrell's character in that movie is that he's not that smart a guy.
Yes.
He's kind of like a, maybe a street smart,
maybe probably was homeless clever. For a majority of his life.
He's not that smart a guy, yeah. And he's going through an existential crisis that he can't mm-hmm. articulate.
Exactly. But he's so earnest about it. That's the thing. He wishes he could. He almost wishes he...
Oh, yeah. He looks to Brendan Gleeson's character yes. for guidance. Yes. And when they're looking at that painting or whatever, he yeah. asks him, like, what's that?
Yeah, he's like, that's my favorite
yeah.
painting.
Oh, yeah. And I don't know. So I think it's kind of unique having a protagonist go through a journey he doesn't even understand himself.
Yes.
And...
Until the end where he gives like a the most articulated monologue probably the character's ever spoken through the film. Yeah. It's great. It's really good.
Yeah.
And it's after seeing Ralph Fiennes' character sort of play out to the his code, the moral yeah. code of like what they like the hitman moral code playing yes. it out to its extreme.
Oh my god, and that's just so freaking.
And I love that even the Canadian couple comes back. I love that every character plays a role in that film where you always think it's the tip of the iceberg for that character, and you're like, oh, a midget, like this is funny, he's addicted to drugs, like, this is ironic, and then the Canadian couple, oh, no smoking, haha, knocks them out, and then how it all comes back around, and the universe never forgets that these people are humans, right? It really never forgets that. And it could have, man, when I first watched the movie, I thought it was going to end with, like, a laugh. I thought it was going to be, like, they all, like, Brendan Gleeson and Colin Farrell run off with the midget beside them hand in hand into the sunset.
To comedy in the darkest sense.
Exactly. It's gallows humor. It's why
I
people
really
tell
love
jokes when they're about to get
Carter
hung.
Burwell's
like,
score is actually one of my favorite.
Yeah,
that's beautiful. That yeah. same melody that keeps coming in and out.
Yeah, and a really subdued score for like a supposedly like a hitman movie.
And I love that they won't have a gunfight in a building that has a pregnant woman in it.
Yeah,
no, they have such
that
big
was,
standards.
I was for one of my film scenes that we were doing in our film class. It was a three-hander.
Mm.
It was me. Chris Fader and Tracy Varju, who are in my were in my class since I graduated, and we wanted to do that scene, and I thought that would be the coolest freaking scene to recreate because there's dialogue that we don't hear that's in the script before that entire scene happens mm-hmm. between Ralph Fiennes and the innkeeper, right between the two of them, and then it goes into that, and it's just so it's so perfectly just like that's what it is. And the thing is, she's not even in the middle, right? She's not standing in between them. She's standing right in front of Ralph Fiennes, right at the very edge of the staircase. And kind of the interlude that they have between each other, and like that pointless question that he asks, you know, it's like, is the river left or right? Right when he knows where the river is. We just saw him by the river. Mm-hmm. He should know where it is. So that was, you know, that scene especially was just freaking awesome.
Yeah.
Martin McDonagh's brother, I think, just had a film play a festival recently.
Yeah.
With Brendan Gleeson in it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it would be any good, but that's something to look out for,
yeah.
just in case, to share some of his brother's talent.
So, what's new with everyone? Let's go around the circle and ask. Alice, what's...
In what regard?
What's the most recent movie everyone's seen?
Okay, yeah.
The most recent.
Alice, go.
I rewatched and thoroughly enjoyed myself some Death Wish Part 2 the other night, which is great.
I'm gonna get you.
That movie is
just rampant.
Yeah, it's against a drunk man just inflicting his rage upon a society that he can't understand. And I love that all of the guys smoke weed. I love that. I think it's the most heinous subduing about if you smoke weed you will be a rapist parallel I've ever seen in my life. Like, every time there's like, yeah, hit this shit, man, and then the next scene it's like, take a fucking clothes off! It's like, I do not feel that way when I'm on weed. Like, I almost don't want to have sex. Like, I don't even want to get into that. And the rape scene is horrific, both of them. I've never seen a back-to-back rape scene, and they don't even show
the
lead.
I love me a rape scene.
Yeah, it's two of them. The maid gets raped and killed, and then the girl gets raped and, like, is okay with it because she's so shell-shocked from being raped in the first movie, and then she just jumps out a window, and then the fucking movie starts, and then, like, cuts to Bronston, and as if it's, like, spider rape sense is going off, and he's just like, I gotta get my gun, like, and it just, like, goes from there, and he inflicts revenge, and it's terrifying, and at the end, the moral dilemma of society is he goes into this prison where the guy's being held, the last guy that he has to kill, and he goes in, kills the guy, and the nurse who's there, the male nurse, sees the last bit of it go down and is like standing there watching, and the alarm's right beside him, and he like goes for it, and Bronson's like, no, he's like, you don't understand, this guy killed and raped my daughter. And the guy straight up just moves his hand away from the alarm, and it's just like, that's America, like, if they deserve it, you should kill them. And Bronson gets away with it, and the ending is just as crazy as the one where it just ends with him pointing his finger at the camera in the shape of a gun and winking. It ends with him being at this building conference, and this old guy who's just been arbitrarily in the movie as his boss is like, so, like, we haven't seen you around the office at night lately, like, what are you gonna be doing for the banquet, like, are you gonna come, you're never at the events, and he's like, I'll be there, like, what else would I be doing? And then he first looks at the camera, and then it cuts just a silhouette of him with a gun, and you just hear, bang, bang, and then the movie just cuts, and the credits go by so fast. I've never seen credits
TV.
Like that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it was the hilarious TV edit that followed that, like, the abrupt, most abrupt ending followed by the most abrupt credits. Yeah, I was just like, whoa! Like, are you kidding me? And, yeah, it's crazy. Crazy fucking film, Death Wish. I would recommend all 5 Death Wishes to anyone. Death Wish 3 is really good. There's a scene.
How many death wishes can one person have?
He made them right up in... Is he alive still?
He made them until he died.
Yeah, and... yeah,
that's how the wish is
the third one is ridiculous because it's the same kind of gangster kids that smoke weed, rape people, you know, typical shit that kids do, and they're just creating this gang. He goes back to New York because he's in LA in the second one for no reason. He's just like, I need some different scenery, and then like, and then he's back in New York, and there's just this Tommy gun. They show this huge gun, and he just looks at it at one point in the movie. He's like, that could hurt a lot of people. And then it shows later when these gangs are taking over the city, these gangs of like 20 and 30 kids, and the cops are just getting beat down because their batons and guns won't do anything for some reason. He just like gets that Tommy gun, walks on the street, and I shit you not, there's one scene where just 30 like kids our age, 20, like run around the corner with like pipes, and there's like, what the fuck? And he's just got this machine gun, and he just unloads and drops every single one of them. And I was cheering. I was just like, yeah, you weed smoking fucks, like. And something I noticed from watching too many Death Wish, there's always a guy in the corner every time they do a cut and show the gang just fucking sculpting something. He always has a knife out, and it's always a different dude, and he's like propping the one on himself, just sculpting away, and it'll like cut between the guy touching his teeth and the one guy smoking a cigarette, and then it's the sculptor. I don't even know why he's there. Like, what is he making? Yeah, you never see what he's making. He's always like, and then always they'll have him like the dude will come in, he'll just drop it so abruptly. He was like so into his project of art, and then just like, no, and throws it to the ground.
How funny would that be, that through a progression of all 5 of the movies,
he eventually ends in a boat.
Yeah, it's the same sculptor, and for some reason at the end of it, it goes into Evan Almighty.
Yeah, you realize,
and it's like, hey, I'm Steve Carell. That's some fucking art.
But Bronson's entire moral message is the last scene. It's the guy so aged from whittling in the back of all these scenes, and he just walks to a boat, gets in the boat, and sails away. Just like, directed by Charles Bronson. And also bizarre. I think that would have been the better way to end the franchise. Yeah. I've not seen the last Death Wish, though. I'd be very interested to see it. Yeah. All I know is it deals heavily with drugs. He gets into cocaine, which, if I've seen his weed smoking portrayal, I want to see cocaine, because they're probably like, do a line like, let's go murder! Like, just like,
So Kurt, what about you?
Yeah.
Well, I haven't watched a movie in 4 months. Briefly, I have some undiagnosed medical problem, which affects my visual concentration, so I can't watch movies because I can't focus on them.
The irony.
Of being a cinephile. It's tragic. So yeah, last movie I watched was Universal Soldier Regeneration.
Nice.
Which is...
GCVD, man.
Yeah, it's best movie he's ever been in.
Really?
It's straight to video, but it's like one of the best looking action movies of recent years. Yeah, the director is the son of the guy who directed 2010, the sequel to 2001. And it's just really visually economical, and yeah, it's great. There's not much. It's more of a work of form than
just really content. Smooth,
really
tight.
Just well put together, and yeah.
Because like, I'm a John Carpenter fan, I know you aren't as much. Right?
Well, I love The Thing.
You love This Thing, but like, that's like.
Do you like Escape from New York?
That's not, even though The Thing's
no.
Like his best movie.
What?
It's for me, it doesn't hold the, like, what I love about him.
Yeah, I know what you mean. What is that movie, Scarface, where Pauline Kael says it's the Brian De Palma movie for people who don't like Brian De Palma?
Yeah.
Maybe The Thing is the equivalent for me in some ways. But I wouldn't say I don't like Carpenter.
Yeah.
And I think the more I watch Carpenter, the more I'll like him.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're just fundamental things that just don't agree with me. But it's not necessarily criticism. It's not something I'd criticize.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just one of those rare cases where something just doesn't fit. You know, the viewer and the movie, it just doesn't.
Do you find anything morally objectionable?
See, that's the thing. No criticisms. It's not,
because the subject's very, the content in all those other movies. Well,
yeah.
No, I haven't seen like some of the major
just
ones.
Just in general.
But they're pretty light, and that's the point. Because
None of those issues. But it's just like I don't enjoy them. I don't have fun.
Mm-hmm.
And his movies, you know. Having fun is a big part of his movies.
Escape from New York.
But I mean,
that
we
so
watched
much fun.
The last 20 minutes recently of The Last Action Hero.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Now they're actually similar.
Did you guys see that one as kids?
Never.
No.
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh my god.
They're actually similar in some ways. McTiernan and Carpenter in a sort of sense of that 80s sense of fun.
Yeah, yeah.
That doesn't always work for me. Last Action Hero, like. Based on the last 20 minutes, that was a great film.
Yeah.
And I had tons of fun watching
it. I think Last Action Hero, though, is undertaking bigger things, though. Like,
yeah.
I think it's genuinely looking at a child's relationship with movies and spectacle.
So perhaps,
perhaps
McTiernan, for me, there's an access point for me into the fun.
Yeah.
Where for Carpenter, for some reason, when it comes to Big Trouble in Little China, specifically, I can't find the access point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That gateway into that world, I can't get
And
to.
Good segue, I feel like that's probably the access point that you were not able to find on I Saw the Devil also.
We can come back to that.
I want to talk about this
in a few minutes. We haven't Carpenter's.
No,
thing.
No, exactly.
We
okay, can continue
about.
On. So
yeah, yeah. But we'll get back to that. But I don't know though. Like, let's hone in on Escape from New York because for
now,
me that's
mind you,
probably
I,
the best
I actually
film.
Like Escape from New York. Just
yeah, yeah.
I don't think it's a great film.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's probably maybe his best, even though like the content is fairly light, but it's mostly just an excuse to just open up this world,
which is just a beautiful world.
Oh my
god. Yeah.
Like, it's just every single image is just packed with production design, like beats like Heaven's Gate and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
see, but there it actually reminds me of Blade Runner, to a certain extent.
No, because Blade Runner really loves its narrative and itself and its soundtrack, and Carpenter's films are just looking at its surfaces and I find the best likening from my experience with Carpenter is people's experience with Miyazaki of just falling into this like fantasy world,
right?
Where spectacle is not embodied narrative but more so just in the grandeur
and
of
yeah,
images,
and you fall in love with this action hero right away, and you start to think about things he's thinking about, like you realize that building you have to get back to at the end, and that jet's your only way out, and all the while there's that thing that's going to explode in him, and suddenly the more buildings he gets led to, and the more side events you get, and you're like, no, you got your mission, like you're like you fall in love with the fact that there's this franticness to it. And I remember the first time I was like, this is going to be basic, he's going to get chased around by hobos, and then out of nowhere they bring in this huge set piece of the library or whatever it is, the chapel, that big circular building that he goes into, and you start to realize he's getting roped into something a lot bigger than what he understands, and all the while I still found myself thinking about it, being just as stressed out from being like, man, you've walked pretty far, you better hope you can fucking run back to that like that plane. And then literally I was that into it, I was that stressed out for it.
See, and I kind of envy that. It's not like I'm going into these movies like being stuck up or you know, being resistant to it, but for some reason Kurt Russell for me, you know, in The Thing as an everyman, love him.
You didn't like him as the cocky badass?
No, I like him, but I don't have that same reverence for him that you guys do.
In Escape from New York, I don't really pay attention to characterization as much.
Yeah.
It's there. I think his character is cool, and but it takes itself just as seriously as the score does.
Yeah.
And which the score doesn't take itself very seriously at all, because it's not like this huge, heavy, like, you know, but for me, Escape from New York. Sorry, we'll end it on this final one of these final things. But Escape from New York articulates.
Shut up.
It was one of the best. Okay, it was one of the best articulations of cinema's relationship with history that I've experienced. In just the scenes where he flies in and lands on the World Trade Center with his plane. Like,
that is a fucking no.
Oh, no, but like, just you'd be lying if in the context which we're watching the movie now didn't affect the dramatics of the movie. Like, like, and it's so, how it's photographed is just this really dark, empty New York City, and you know, the special effects beat the shit out of anything today, and he just lands on this World Trade Center that's just like empty. And I don't know. I'm not articulate enough to.
No. I think you understand.
Yeah. So yeah, that's what it does for me.
So should we continue on with the latest movie?
Yeah. What have you seen lately?
Okay. So from Death Wish 2 to Universal Soldier Regeneration to Hong Sang-soo's Virgin Strip Bare by Her Bachelors. Which I thought was a masterpiece, and I'm going to alienate you guys because you haven't seen it. But I guess each film so far, only one of us has seen it.
Yeah.
But yeah, for those who don't know, Hong Sang-soo.
Crash is almost falling asleep.
No, I'm not. I'm just.
Well, that was a snore. That was like.
Yeah, I'm an actor, asshole. Of course. Yeah. Look, I could.
Okay. Continue.
Hong Sang-soo, for those who don't know. He's a Korean filmmaker whose films all have roughly the same premise, where boy meets girl, maybe there's a love triangle, maybe it's two pairs of lovers, etc., etc. And there's usually a different sort of gimmick in each of his movies, something that sort of puts a new spin on the same premise. Mm-hmm. He's compared to Woody Allen in that he revisits, he sort of just puts himself on screen in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And
he makes a movie every year?
And he makes a movie every year, and revisits the same sort of ideas, but this is the best one I've seen out of the four of his films
Tale
I've seen.
Tale of Cinema, Opie's Movie.
Ha ha ha.
And
this one.
Yeah, okay.
And this is by far the best. It's absolutely amazing. I'd actually love to do like a triple bill with The Mother and the Whore. Virgin Strip Bare by Her Bachelors.
That's a long triple bill.
And a Gorel,
wow. So you just like those.
It's black and white.
Okay.
Calm.
Yeah. Domestic dramas.
Domestic dramas,
yeah.
That are just gentle and quaint, but then
but Mother and the Whore is huge.
No. Like, you know what I mean? Small in a certain sense. Narrow.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then there's this huge weight.
It scopes in on, you know, an apartment and three characters kind of thing.
Yeah, okay. For a Hong Sang-soo movie, all you need are two different restaurant / bar interiors, three unique street sets.
Mm-hmm.
And three to four characters.
Yeah.
And you can shoot a Hong Sang-soo film.
Yeah.
I love it. I'm going to watch everything he's done.
Yeah.
Very accessible.
It's such an
too.
Inviting world. It's like Ozu or something. Like,
it's similar to Ozu, especially because you can just have.
You just know you're going to get the same package every time, but the package is perfect. Like,
exactly. And a commonality between the two is you have just people sitting and drinking.
Yeah.
Oh, so it's like the Big Mac guy. You guys know the Big Mac guy from Supersize Me, right? He gets like three Big Macs a day. It's perfect for him, and he never changes. Right? Right?
Oh, that guy.
Yeah, that guy.
See the likening.
Okay, you brought it up. We're gonna dig into this. So they're talking about the guy who eats. All he does is eat Big Macs. He's in perfect health for whatever fucking reason.
Is this
defying all the laws of McDonald's?
There is lettuce in those things.
Yeah, there is
yeah, tomatoes,
iceberg lettuce without nutrients in those things.
You'd be like, extra lettuce.
So you're saying that guy's happy with Big Macs every day?
Ever asked for extra
if he wasn't happy with his Big Macs, he would go and get another thing to eat. But if he's ordering three fucking Big Macs a day,
so you're comparing him to an auteur who revisits the same material. Similar material.
But finds new things in them every
time. So are you saying this guy finds new? I think this guy's just fucking Big Macs. I think he's ruining his fucking life. I don't care.
Okay. You know what? maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we have to send an email to Ignati and Christy Lemaire and ask them what they think. No?
Alright, so Rax, what was the latest film you saw?
Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Oh, he loved it.
Yeah. I fucking loved it.
Stick with John McTiernan. He did Last Action.
He did, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I watched a Hong Sang-soo film. We all just watched action movies.
And Ignati thinks Last Action Hero is a masterpiece.
Not
Last Action Hero.
Die Hard with a Vengeance. I think it's a fucking masterpiece.
Yeah. Better than the first Die Hard.
Yes.
I'd love to see it.
Maybe a way to close out the series if you don't want to watch the fourth one.
Yeah, fourth one was just
Chris
stupid.
Rock.
Yeah.
Just fucking
Joe
stupid.
Pesci.
No, that's Lethal Weapon, dude.
That's Lethal Weapon.
Oh my god. I just rewatched it and it's just... Oh my god, it's like I don't know how
isn't
to explain
it. Like almost like 3 hours? Like
yeah,
really long.
Yeah, it's
oh,
really
really?
Fucking long.
It's
those movies aren't usually built to last.
But it's one of those, it's one of these films that just, there's so much freaking going on, and it's like, okay, for me, it's like, have you ever watched The Amazing Race, for example?
I have.
Yes. Okay, no, bear with
you're
me here for a second, alright? Because I'm trying to get onto parallels that, you know, I feel that are close to what I...
It's like the guy that ate the burger!
Yeah!
Alright, so...
She's got a grass!
Okay.
Amazing Race!
No, so, well, no, you're watching The Amazing Race, and, you know, it's that...
Anderson Cooper?
No, wrong guy.
No,
guns.
No,
that's the
last season.
The mole, dude. When's the last time I
Where's the mall?
You know that got taken off. You know that. Do you know why that show got taken off the air?
Why?
Because after the first season aired, that was 2000. And then what happened in 2001, September 11th? The trade towers went down. Suddenly no one was into watching a show about who a secret terrorist is. So, dude, they didn't renew it. They just told that stupid. They were like, it would be uncool to bring the mall back. And he was like, I agree. I'm in the news. And then just like, they just didn't bring it back.
Shit, the mole was awesome.
It was.
Because every episode, I'm just like, who the fuck is the mole, right? It's just normal fucking
every
people.
Episode, I'm like, I would be doing these traps so much better. I remember the one where they're trapped. I remember the one where they're trapped in the hotel rooms, the different hotel rooms, and they've got a bicycle there that, like, powers a light. And I remember the one guy was just riding the bike the entire time, not even trying anything else. The phone's, like, ringing. He's like, oh, whatever. Maybe if I ride this bike, this light will somehow, like, open the door. I'm like, you're retarded.
I should be the mole!
Exactly.
Yeah. So going back to my amazing race analogy, watching that film is like the tension and the excitement of because they have all these specific tasks that they have to do. Aside from that, the NYPD has to deal with the whole, you know, school situation with.
It was a sweet subcast. I love that sidecast. And they're just like, I've never
who's
seen.
Who is that random First Nations guy?
I don't know.
In all those movies?
I don't know, and he's the coolest guy.
Yeah, he's the coolest dude.
This guy. When they're
God.
At the school and the fat fuck
throws
the bomb,
dude.
And she's like, you don't know what you're doing.
You don't know what you're doing.
Amazing Race or Die Hard?
Die Hard!
Wait, I thought we were talking about the mole!
Okay. But it's just one of those films that just, it's fucking, it's absolutely relentless in the amount of entertainment it has, and kind of, I mean, the iconicism with fucking Bruce Willis going down a Harlem street with a sign that says, I hate niggers.
Yeah.
I'm allowed to say that.
Yeah.
Well,
it's in the context of the film.
Yeah.
You are the closest black person we know. So.
Thank you. So that, you know, the iconicism with that, and that it's this really retarded commentary with Samuel L. Jackson, Bruce Willis, and this kind of racial thing that they're fighting the entire time. Mm-hmm. Like one of the parts where they're on the boat, I think, and then Bruce Willis flips it on Samuel L. Jackson, and he's like, you know what? You're racist. And he's like, what? Yeah, you hate white people. You just want white people to hate black people. And he's like, no, I'm not racist. You guys are the ones that are racist. Mm-hmm. He just flips that shit on him. And Jeremy Irons is just... Ever since I saw this movie when I was a kid, Jeremy Irons freaked the fuck out of me. Mm-hmm. And then I saw him in that stupid Dungeons & Dragons movie. And then I lost all respect for
him. I've seen that.
No, my God, I lost all respect for him.
Two notes.
Oh, yeah.
But two notes on why Die Hard is badass.
Yeah.
First off, Samuel L. Jackson's first scene is monologue to the kid trying to give him
the
radio that was stolen. He's like, you think that if I fucking take this radio from you and resell it, eventually the guy who you stole it from is going to come in and just like return it to whoever you got it from and just calls him on it.
No, he says something
shop.
Like,
yes.
Yeah, he tells his kids, he's like,
who gave this?
No, it's like, what are you going to go do after this? Go to school. Why? So we can go to college. Mm-hmm. It's like, why are you going to go do that? So we can get a good education. Why? Because we need jobs. And who's going to help you? Nobody. And what? Who do we not want help from? Especially white people. All right, go to school.
And that's like the greatest thing to know. Teach your kids in Harlem, such a hardcore area.
Yeah.
So, secondly, the flashback, the only time they show a scene from another is the image of his
brother falling,
and it's what Bruce Willis must have seen as he was looking down, and it's on Bruce Willis's eyes, and it's just like, this is literally the last thing he saw is this man that he caused to plunge through that, and he looks scared.
Yeah.
That's the thing, and it's just like, you almost feel like Bruce Willis is almost the bad guy in that situation. You understand?
Yeah, I remember it being really morally ambiguous
in
that way.
And he's hung over the entire time.
Yeah.
He's a dick.
Like,
he's lost his wife.
The one part that kind of scarred me as a child was the sickle scene. It's when she comes in with this crazy sickle, and there's this fat guard, this white guard that she kills, right? And I remember just her, it's the image of her walking down, and then as she's walking down into frame, the sickle's shown. And as a child, I'm like, oh, God, no.
And it's very bloody. It's a rated R film.
Yeah,
it's very bloody.
I think Jeremy Irons, like, one of the best things in that movie is when Samuel Jackson's on the boat and he points the gun at him. And Jeremy Irons is just eating an apple. Mm. And he's like, and Samuel Jackson's like, well, I'm going to have to shoot you. And Jeremy Irons is like, okay, well, if you have to shoot me, shoot me. And Samuel Jackson's like, okay. Okay, he clicks it, and just click. And Jeremy Irons is just eating this apple. He's like, takes the gun. He's like, you got to turn the safety off. Turns the safety off, and just is still eating the apple, shoots him in the foot, and then walks away. He's like, okay.
Yeah.
Which ejaculation do you prefer? Which adolescent ejaculation do you prefer? The squid and the whale or happiness? Everyone, has anyone seen both of these movies?
Yeah,
squid and whale
happy,
is
like happiness,
so
happiness?
Depressing.
Huh?
Like happiness?
Like happiness.
Yeah, he ejaculates at the end. And squid and the whale, he ejaculates in rum.
Oh,
down.
Those movies are so like, oh, they're like, oh, everyone's just like awful and everything's awful and God, can't we just watch The Notebook?
Yeah, Gosling, man.
Yeah.
Yo, I got a beer now. That's
Nick
a way
Cash
to show time progression. Yeah. Hey, how about that in cinema, where whenever they want to show an amount of time has passed, just grow a beard.
Yeah, there's some.
It's everything. It's like cinematic. Lost was the most infamous one because Jack's hair did not grow, yet he grew a Grizzly Adams beard.
Who's seen the Squid and the Whale?
Squid and the Whale?
Yeah, like Crash of you?
No.
Okay.
Well, let's talk it briefly. Well,
go for it.
You don't like the film.
I might. I don't know.
I think it's actually a very good movie. It's not a great movie, but
I think it's really hard to make movies about really awful people, especially when everyone's really awful.
Mm-hmm.
And Baumbach's like obsessed with getting it right. I think he knows he's not getting it right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's got a long way to go, but like he can make masterful movies eventually, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I think Margot at the Wedding was a step back.
Mm.
And I think Greenberg was a monumental step forward.
Mm.
Greenberg's pretty close to
me. Worst thing about Greenberg, bar none, for me, is just it's a movie that kind of excludes mise-en-scene and then picks and chooses when it wants it. So, like, the party scene, I think, is from a different film. When it starts zooming in and is honing in on his neuroses and the soundtrack's building and it's trying to communicate his anxiety, like Punch Drunk Love or something. And I don't think that's the movie. I think it's outside of him. And when it starts representing him on the surface of the film, it's going against itself.
Interesting.
But yeah, I think he's getting there though.
He's cinematically aware, based on the interview with Brian De Palma on the Blowout
special. Yeah. You know, what films did he talk about and stuff?
Well, it's not necessarily the films, it's just like he knows that De Palma's trying to communicate.
Yeah.
You know, pretty much everywhere. He's pretty in sync with De Palma when they're talking.
Yeah.
There's not a point where De Palma leaves him in the dust or anything.
Yeah.
And
so is De Palma like really articulate in this interview?
He's straightforward.
Yeah.
But articulate.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, he openly discusses, you know, his thoughts on his own movie and movies, you know, and filmmaking.
Yeah.
From very on an artistic level only.
Yeah.
None of that bullshit you get in a normal interview. Right?
Yeah.
It's O'Toole and O'Toole.
Yeah.
They're discussing O'Toole-ism.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's an interesting subject of Rashomon, get off your computer. And...
No, I have no idea what you guys are talking about.
Yeah, you've seen Greenberg. In.
I've seen Greenberg. I fucking hated Greenberg.
And, you know,
stupid.
Fucking two out of three green turds.
But why do you think it is stupid?
Because it was
I'm not far behind you.
No, I just felt like it was... Why Ben Stiller is just not... It just didn't work for me. I didn't understand where it was going. I didn't know what the fuck the ending was about. Mm. It was like they didn't under... Like, it was Baumbach or whatever?
Noah Baumbach?
It was like you got to the end of the movie and it's like, well, I was trying to say something. I don't know exactly what I was trying to say. But, you know, hey, why don't we end it this way and then someone can maybe interpret what I was trying to think I was saying and then I'll just take credit for what they said. Yeah, I didn't understand. I didn't care. I'm like, yeah, there's this guy who's...
But that's... You shouldn't, like, guess.
I'm not guessing, but that's just... I just felt like...
But you didn't care, like,
I didn't care. I just... That was such a crapshoot of an ending because I had to go and I had to find some space within myself to invest in this character that I really... Neither of them I really gave a shit about because they were just pompous and pretentious and just
full of crap. He makes movies about bad people. And I think, and they're trying to correct themselves.
But this is the thing, though. It's like, yeah, I understand making movies about bad people, but if we're going to talk about this, we have to correlate that people, in a very diluted sense, right, they have a choice. They're either good or they're bad, right? Bad for whatever decision society deems bad to be at the time. Good for whatever society deems to be good at the time, right? But at the really end... Well, okay, if you were raised in a society, Kurt, that said, you know, having underage sex was okay, if you were raised in it, right, Kurt right now would say, no, that's kind of fucked up, but Kurt in that environment, it would be like drinking water, it wouldn't really, you know, pass. But, okay, but the point I'm trying to get to is that within the core idealism of every human being and every actor and anything, it boils down to the choice. The choice that there's that really neutrality about that person. Right? I can be an asshole, I can be a douchebag, I can be all that stuff and be a terrible person, right? But at the end of it, I'm doing those things for a reason. I'm doing those things because I see things in a different way that other people see them. Right, but as an actor, I have to portray that to the audience to say, okay, listen, you might be seeing me on a surface level to be a bad person, but really deep down, there are reasons why I'm like this. This is why I'm like this. And
you're saying, and you're suggesting Greenberg doesn't suggest that.
It's a movie about an really asshole, and it's just, he doesn't change. I mean,
he changes.
Last gesture.
Well, no, he's on his way to changing.
Yeah.
But
it's very subtle.
Baumbach doesn't want to, and I'm lightly defending this movie because I don't love it. But you can clearly tell he doesn't like arcs. He likes having change suggested at the end of the movie instead of in the arc of the movie.
Yeah.
And
he likes to see how characters arrive at change.
Yeah. And also, like, you gotta question a lot. There's movies which feature bad people or self-absorbed people at the center. They often, you know, water it down for entertainment purposes. And I think that's what people want when they watch Noah Baumbach movies. And he brings you, like, really to an uncomfortable place. And he doesn't water it down.
Mm-hmm.
But there's other problems. But, what do you want from Greenberg?
What do I want from Greenberg or what I remember from it?
Yeah.
Because I cut off
and washed
it out of my mind.
Yeah.
I don't know. I really, that story doesn't appeal to me. I just didn't feel that Ben Stiller's just not that understanding of an actor because I think he's very surface and whenever I look at him, I never see into him. I see what he thinks he is.
Yeah, because
and what
he's self-absorbed. You can't really see into someone like that. That's not what the performance is going for.
Yeah, but why would I want to see a self-absorbed performance? That's like someone in a
corner. No,
because we're examining self-absorption.
Yeah.
But then why
examining blank stares and all those things, like the coffee shop scene with Jennifer Jason Leigh is like so hard to watch.
Oh, it's tough. Yeah. Well, and that frustration, I mean, that's, you know, what Baumbach is going for.
Put the bunny back in the box.
No, you know what you gotta do is put the bunny back in the box.
Hey,
now
you're here with Nicolas Cage and Christopher Walken.
Hello, can you
hear
me?
We're just doing my tax forms right now.
Yes, C4 is nice. So, how much
door for so long?
I need to know, how much money did you make last year, and how much did you spend on
sales? Well, you know, I was really spending most of my money on just kind of fast cars, and, you know, paying for my son's metal band.
You know, sometimes I dress up as a ninja, and no one can really see me move. When I'm in the darkness...
Oh, hey, man, that's cool. Sometimes, you know, I just put on a sorcerer's costume and have a movie made about it.
Yeah, sometimes I have a cardboard cutout of Luther Vandross, and I just touch it. Yeah, that's what I do. Bang, bang, ba-bang. Nice. So, I think maybe we should end this podcast. No? Or should we keep going?
No, I actually...
I was, now that Nicolas Cage and Christopher Walken are on, I was actually thinking that we'd do another round table, and mine was, it's getting a little late, everybody loves them, your favorite horror movie, and why? Why the, something that scared the shit out of you, but something that was also artistic, of cinema value, and I mean, we all see, I gotta argue that most films that I see that grip me the hardest are the ones that are eerie, but not scary, and,
Yeah, atmospheric.
Yeah, I think that's. I think it's a very appropriate topic.
Blair Witch Project, Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah, you're a Blair Witch supporter.
I'm a Blair Witch supporter.
That's.
I mean, I don't support the Blair Witch, but the Blair Witch Project, the film.
The project of the Blair Witch, not the Blair Witch.
Yeah,
I'll defend
that movie.
Yeah.
I don't want the Blair Witch. But the fact that we just meant, I'm already freaked out a little bit.
Okay, so I'm gonna. I'll start if that's okay. Yeah. I will do a shout out to. The only film that Zack Snyder's made that was good, and that is the remake of Dawn of the Dead, and also the original. They both.
Wow, you're gonna take my choice.
They both capture the human condition.
You call them horrifying, though?
The original, yes. The original is horrifying because it's humanity against them. It's not the zombies. The zombie threat is scary and is used to propel events and tension. But at the end of the day, it's the fact that they're in this mall creating this idyllic life. And it's other humans that are their undoing. And that has always been tragic and horrifying.
See, you think it's
me.
More the implications.
Yes, and the way the zombies are done, they're cheap, it's gritty, it's exactly what the 70s was, and it was putting out very, very honest films that are made to be on this epic scale, but it still has that 70s cheese. But it's scary. I remember seeing the SWAT guys, who are your two leads, the black man and Ken, and they go downstairs. Ironic that I remember him only as the black man. I remember the white man's name.
Wait, Ving Rhames?
But yeah, no. This is the original. Let's forget about the remake because it's good, but it's not what I want to talk about. In the original, they go down, and the first time you see the SWAT man, is they go downstairs, and a priest has bound people and is trying to pray for them, and they first see the zombie threat, and then their squad gets taken out. And I just love the new set and everything. I love how it's handled because it's done through the same lens that World War Z is done through. And it's a, what if humans were reacting to this virus in a realistic way? Because they're not always just going to fuck up, right? They're not always going to fall. You see in so many movies... they're overpowered, but us humans, we have cities for a reason because we're able to be the alpha. And I feel like that's something that Dawn of the Dead really shows, is how humanity can be powerful and it can take back this thing when they build this mall, but then how it can get powerful to the point of being barbaric, which is when the bikers come in. And they are the survivors. You suddenly realize, seeing the other bikers that they're passing by on their road trip to the mall, that those people that have no connections to any family, have nothing, no stakes in the world, they might be the next race of man, if there were to ever be something that would make us go back to those barbarian-esque roots. Mm-hmm. And the film horrifies me. I've never been so attached to characters. Mm-hmm. I think it has amazing cinematography. I love when it's the final news broadcast and their friend is reanimating in the corner and his friend has to put him down. Mm-hmm. The way the gun is shot and the way that he sits up, it's forever horrifying. And No CG, too. Fucking love that. I love seeing hordes of the undead that you know are people, because it's so much scarier. Mm-hmm. Because having 1,000 people coming in on you in varied numbers and in various spaces, mm-hmm. It's that entrapment feeling that zombies have always been horrifying for. Mm-hmm. You're in a central location, and there's always corners to a room, and you're just waiting until you're back in that corner. And that was that is literally what happens to, I'll say it again, the black man, who is in the corner and has the gun, and the zombies are piling in, and it's literally a man forced in the corner. Mm-hmm. And he never misses a beat with being cynical, because the last scene, they get away in the helicopter, the pregnant lady and the black man, and they say, where are we going to go? We're going to fly. And then just to be a big fuck you, to make you worry, because that's what he wants to do, he wants to scare you, is he's like, we don't have much fuel left. And it's like, they're fucked. Like, their copter's going to go down, and it's just going to restart again. They're going to be weaker. Mm-hmm. But it shows some great human spirit. And there's a headshot in it where you see a black lady with an afro get her head blown open.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the original ending had been that the black man gets cornered,
yeah, yeah,
and he blows his own brains out, and leaves the pregnant lady to get eaten alive.
Yeah.
And they told Romero that was, like, too dark. Like, that's too much, man.
Yeah, I don't know what that would suggest either.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it has no catharsis, right?
Yeah.
And the black man was not weak. I keep saying that and undermining him, but that is probably one of the first times I watched cinema, and it sounds racist, but it's very hard. I'm sure black people have the same problem with white people identifying with them as leads.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw that man, and I was like, he is the better man. And he is something to aspire to be. And that actor was phenomenal. Fucking love the original Dawn of the Dead, 1978, I believe, 73,
yeah,
something like
78.
Good poster on my door, right when you walk in, the original one. Man, great film.
Yeah.
Kurt, what scares the shit out of you, Pete?
I don't know.
What scares the poop out of your pants?
I'm having trouble coming up with my favorite one.
I was going to say Sallow, but I don't want to talk about Sallow.
Yes.
I was going to say Inland Empire, but you can't talk about Inland Empire. I don't think you can. Every attempt I've heard to try and talk about Inland Empire is just like verbal diarrhea.
It's beautiful, though.
I don't know. I don't really get horrified by genre films anymore.
Yes.
Genre films that fulfill the genre of horror, but like, so I kind of have to look at my childhood and kind of my... Because that's when horror cinema is most terrifying.
Yes, and you don't quite understand how things are shot or pulled off, and effects are so much bigger than life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, it's a...
I don't know. Maybe Halloween? I remember watching Halloween on VHS. Have you guys seen the original Halloween?
Yeah,
that was last year.
Yeah.
That and the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre
are
good additions. Like, with that, they make the slasher genre relevant,
mm-hmm.
pretty much is what they do.
Because
an unrelenting person with a weapon is pretty fucking scary.
Well,
Texas
Chainsaw Massacre is like...
It's like beauty and chaos, but so starched, like the scene where the girl's getting chased in the clotheslines with the...
That's insane.
Scene is, like, so scary, and, like, you think it's happening.
Yeah.
You really do.
Well, it's
like
the first one of the first to be cinema verite. Like, it's just so straight up.
Well, they're dutching the camera and shooting it upwards,
yeah.
and he's like a monster,
yeah.
and she's down. Like, when they shoot her, she's on the ground and stuff.
Actually, the scene where Leatherface first comes out, when they wander to the house, which is pretty much one of the first, maybe one of the first scenes where, you know, it's now a watermark of American horror films of a character wandering off and going into a house. So she goes to this house. Is it a girl or a guy who goes in? I can't remember. And Leatherface it's in a wide shot.
Yeah.
He doesn't cut in for close-ups or
mid
shots. Just pops out screaming, and you see when he slides open that door, you see this red wall with things behind, because that movie is all about its production design. That's where the horror is.
Yes.
And then he runs out and just grabs the person and just slaps the thing over the head, and the person's dead, and it's just all within one shot.
And those like, whoever did the set design on that needs to pal it back, because that set design has been forever replicated, especially in this new remake era that we live in, that gritty kind of 70s. They really accomplished an aesthetic back then. I really think that. And just scary. Just scary.
Well, you know,
shit.
They use real, like, pieces of dead animals and stuff, yeah, that were rotting.
Crazy.
And they tried to wrap the interior scenes in the house within, mm-hmm, like 5 days, but they couldn't, so things were rotting in the Texas
heat. Just looked so, and so legit.
Yeah, 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 but no, but like the people were like dropping on the set because how bad it smelled.
It's good though.
And the movie captures the scent.
Yeah, you pretty much smell it.
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah. Okay. Who's next?
Wait, what was your pick?
I think Texas. I don't know.
Is it Halloween? And
yeah,
okay,
Halloween,
whatever.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I don't know. Inland Empire Salad. All those.
Yep, all good ones.
I ain't talking about the other ones though.
Hey. Well, I would say the film that not only scares me the most in general, but actually scares me more every time I watch it. The better I get to know it, the more frightened I am, is with The Shining, which I actually think is one of the better films ever made, and one of Kubrick's very, very best.
Yeah, that scene again is another film where the sets are just impeccable, and you just feel like you can feel what it would be like to be in that either cold room or like warm building, and it's just... It sticks you with those characters, and you are just, you have to be there, and that's the thing. And
what was your, like, how old were you guys when you saw The Shining?
My dad made me watch when I was really young. He just did it to fuck
11?
With me. I know it.
Yeah.
Like, in a good way. He was like, time to man up and show me The Shining.
Oh my god.
Dude, I was...
Oh, that's not manning up.
Man, when,
like...
when the kid's going down the carpet, and he's just like going down, like... Like, this is fucking boring. And then he turns the corner and the girl's there, and I'm just like, oh, what? No!
Yeah.
And it's just like, this is, that movie's gonna do this? Like, you don't expect it to go to that level.
Yeah.
And then, like, I'm like 11, and I'm tripping balls because he's, like, dancing with ghosts and shit. And I'm like, wait, they're alone in this motel. And my dad's like, yeah, like, don't, like, I don't understand psychology. I'm too young.
Yeah.
And the movie was just this mosaic of craziness, and it's literally a father hunting his son to kill him at the end, and I'm like sitting there with my dad, and I'm just like, fuck, man, we better never go on vacation.
How old were you?
I was in grade 6, so how old were you then?
We were all roughly like 11, 12, 13.
No, because I was 12 when I was in like grade 8 of high school.
No,
I'm
you go
December
to grade
8
and 13. You go to grade 8 when you're 13.
No, because I
you
I'm,
turned
I'm
13
December
in
baby.
Grade 8.
Yeah, okay.
So, yeah, I turned 13 grade 8, so I think I was like...
11?
Okay.
Yeah, so, yeah.
And I remember... Well, first, when you run into sexuality in cinema, which is where you run into
the bathroom,
embrace of representation of sexuality as a kid... it's like terrifying,
especially when
they're
just inherently
like, yeah,
like
the bathroom
horror.
So like,
yeah.
I remember the house being empty and I paused it because I was afraid of someone coming home.
Yeah, so you have that
catching me watch this.
Yeah, it was doubly frightening.
Yeah, yeah, it's terrifying. And you have no, and his tracking shots are just like, you have no idea what
you feel like they're going to lead you right into hell.
Yeah, yeah, what could be in the chasm of his tracking shots, and how slowly it's unveiled, because it's like so far, the bathroom, this is like the longest bathroom like I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Like no hotel's a bathroom that long.
Yeah.
And she's like really, it almost feels like it's slow motion, because there's like a curtain, and she like slowly pulls it, and oh, yeah.
The weird thing with me is that, like, if I saw it, I saw it when I was 11.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue that the first time I saw it was the time it scared me the least.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And
yes.
The time
exactly.
I've seen it, like, 4 times in the last 2 or 3 years,
mm-hmm.
the most recent viewing
because
just destroyed me.
Because you just realize, like, it's so uncomfortable. The entire movie, like, as a kid, you're like, the beginning scenes where he's talking to this boss and shit, you're like, you know something's up, but you can't quite understand what it is. And once you know, and once you've grown up, and you can feel uncomfortable like that, it's just like the entire movie, like, the scene where he's talking to this boss in the office, and it's just like, it's just a, it's a weird movie, man, and it's duly meant to be weird.
Oh, yeah.
And, man, I've never seen a movie where the character you think's the coolest, which is the groundskeeper, get murdered.
Scatman. Yep. Scatman Crothers.
That was the first that was the first time I've seen, yeah, like, that movie's not afraid to fuck with you, and that's what good horror should do. It should really.
I think, like, the better you get to know the space and the architecture of the house, the harder it is, the hotel. Like, when you start to realize that, like, where... Is Danny the name of the little boy?
Yeah.
Where Danny drops his teddy bear or something,
mm-hmm.
Like in the first half hour of the movie,
mm-hmm.
where the teddy bear is mm-hmm. where the black guy gets murdered
mm-hmm.
at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you start to realize shit like that,
mm-hmm.
you
feel like you're in that hotel because
you already know
yeah.
what happens later,
yeah.
and you start to realize those things like early
yeah.
on in the movie.
Yeah.
You, it just it really messes with you.
Kubrick does that great, though. He really, especially in his older films, establishes sets and makes you feel like you're there. Like, 2001 A Space Odyssey, that set is so established.
I don't think he wants you to be there, though, I think. Yeah.
With The Shining, I think.
But I know
I think he
mean.
Wants you to feel the architecture in The Shining and feel trapped in that building, you know what I mean?
I think he wants you to leave with it. I don't know if he wants you to...
I know what you're getting at, though.
You want to feel that
the
existential
sense of space
feeling, yeah, that you're, like, there and you understand it, and if you were to be, like, if you were to describe the room and how it would feel and stuff, it would be completely accurate because of how well it's photographed and how the characters move.
I think in his movies you actually end up feeling when you watch a movie, sometimes you can feel sort of on top of the space.
Yes.
Like you can control the space.
Yeah.
When you watch a Kubrick movie, you can't get to where Kubrick is with it. You're dominated by the space.
Yes.
You kind of get overwhelmed by yourself.
Because there's so many like rooms and chasms and things about a big hotel with only three people that tend to be populated by thousands that you'll never know and never explore, and you only ever get the tip of the iceberg.
And he's very careful with what aspects of space he shows. Like, he's very careful that if he shoots this scene a certain way, he knows that it'll affect this scene later in the movie a certain way. And your perception of that space that you've gained.
Yes.
What do you think about the subtext, which becomes clearer and clearer with age?
That's what I mean. That's another thing that makes it scarier.
Are we talking about the same subtext?
What would define the subtext?
The genocide.
The native genocide.
The subtext.
Right, because it was on the... Yeah, it was on
But,
the,
like, it, you know, once you catch it... Once you catch on to that subtext, every time you watch the movie, you explore it a little more.
Mm-hmm.
And my most recent viewing, just like, oh, man, it was so tough. Because you start to realize that there's really, like, there's Indian chants in the soundtrack.
Yeah, yeah.
And stuff, if you listen closely. And, like, something's, like, must be played
backwards. It's almost
backwards
another horrifying level, like the subtext itself.
On the wall in the main room where he's writing his novel, there's a huge native piece of artwork.
Yeah.
There's the scene in the walk-in fridge. The black guy is standing there, and if you look beside him,
you gotta get
there's
the black guy. We've got to get this.
Scatman.
There's a can. I can't remember what product it is, but the logo on the can is a native head.
Yeah.
Like a stereotype Indian head.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then there's another shot of Shelley Duvall, and it's from a different angle. But Kubrick has specifically angled the can again so that the head is where she is.
Mm-hmm.
So, I have, you know, theories on Kubrick and how he uses coding and how he uses subtle coding to actually subconsciously
infiltrate
you and sort of
being brainwashed if it's to make you feel a powerful emotion.
I don't know if he's controlling
film.
You to that level. I think there's quite a bit of freedom in Kubrick film.
No, but
I don't know. I mean, I think he's trying to. I don't think he necessarily wants you to know about the subtext. Trying to subconsciously, just through coding, try and accomplish some sort of catharsis you might not even be aware of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why you feel linked to each scene, and then you realize it slowly. And
it's a tough movie to watch, but it's thrilling.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best. Arash, favorite horror movie?
Probably Unknown.
The William Neeson film.
Yeah.
I get it. Haha, funny. It's
no,
it's so
probably
bad.
It's not that it's scary. It's the theory that I may have to watch that movie again in my life.
It makes
scares the shit out of me, because
that like one day you're gonna walk into a living room, TV's gonna be on, you're gonna look at the TV,
or like
Liam Neeson.
One day I go into my girlfriend's,
by the way,
house.
Has a huge cock. Continue.
Yeah, like all actors in Hollywood.
Should I not have brought that up?
Yeah, how do you know that?
Apparently, this is what I've heard.
He's such a kind gentleman.
It's two Coke cans stacked on top of each other, girth wise.
No, that's not, that is
that's
no,
like,
there is no
that's
way.
That's true, eh? When he does
true.
Sit, it is, he does keep his legs quite like.
there's someone who, it was always been a Hollywood rumor, but then there was someone who actually just came out straight up and said, someone described it as an Evian bottle, and then someone described it as two Coke cans.
I'm just gonna Google Liam Neeson's cock and just see what happens, okay?
Just Google pictures of him sitting down in, like, tighter pants, and you'll be able to tell right away. That shit's not going to be, like,
oh my God.
A grower.
Kevin Smith is obsessed with Liam Neeson's cock.
What? the largest penises in Hollywood.
I shouldn't have brought it up. God. I was just bringing it up as a quick
okay,
aside.
So anyhow, your rebuttal to our serious horror discussion.
Oh my God, wait. The
joke.
Largest penises in Hollywood. Number two, Liam Neeson. He unzipped his pants and an Evian bottle fell out. Janice Dickinson, has said a former lover, Liam Neeson, and somehow we don't think she's talking about the Irish actor's habit of stashing water bottles down his pants. Indeed, Dickinson has claimed that the 6'4 Liam Neeson has the biggest penis of men alive.
He is 6'4.
Which should make you feel kind of dirty the next time you watch Schindler's. Wow.
Who's number one? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, actually, that's
Daniel Craig.
No.
What? No way.
This just in. Daniel Craig has a large penis. Just ask Judi Dench. The distinguished Dame Dench has offered this not-so-distinguished quote after catching an eyeful of her Casino Royale co-stars are licensed to kill, thanks to conveniently placed trailer opposite of his. It's an absolute monster. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. How uncouth of me. King of Craig.
It wasn't just a trailer. They probably boned, and she was like, I was
It's Judi Dench.
Wait,
it's
number three.
He's up, bro.
Marky Mark is number... Yeah, for Dirk Diggler or whatever. Why am I looking at this? scariest movie. I don't know. I've been so, like, kind of... absorbed into 4chan that nothing really scares me anymore. Mm. I've seen so many images of disgustingly terrible things that I'm just not scared.
So go back to your childhood then.
What is 4chan? That's what I want to know.
4chan. If you don't know 4chan, then you don't know 4chan.
Oh, whoa.
No, it's just
elitist motherfucker.
My childhood, Mortal Kombat was scary for me when I was a kid. The scene where Goro breaks the guy in half, that was scary for me.
What's his name? The guy with the glasses.
Johnny Cage.
Johnny Cage gets his back broken.
Shit, that was so sad.
I cried, man.
I love, because at the start of the movie, I'd be like, I'm Johnny Cage!
Yeah, exactly. I always played as him, too. I was like, white boy,
I wonder if that's just our generation, because we grew up with video games. Where you choose a character.
I was totally cool, because I was Scorpion the entire way. It's like in Street Fighter, I was always Ken, and Ken is just amazing.
When I watched Night at the Roxbury, I would always be Chris Kattan.
Yeah. Scary movies. There is this one really fucked up movie, and I don't know what it's called, but it was this story of this this stepfather pretty much just sexually abusing his daughter, like, throughout the film, and, like, beating her with, like, there was this one specific scene where he takes her in a bathroom and just beats her with his belt, and at the end of the film, it's like, she finally gets adopted, but then her parents come back just to see her, just her mom, because her mom finally dished her husband, and then she didn't even want to go back with her mom because her mom didn't do anything. But I remember that after that, watching that movie, my brother kissed me on the cheek. He's like, I love you, right? Just like, as I was just like a little brother, and I freaked out, kicked him in the nuts, and ran to the other room crying.
Because
I was like, don't you ever touch me. I don't want anyone to ever touch me ever again.
You felt that fucking disgust with humanity.
But the most frightening thing ever, and if we're just going to get, you know, outside of movies, but it's kind of in a cinema sort of way, because it is called an FMV, which is a, you know. In Final Fantasy VII, this is completely true. There's two things. When spoiler alert, fucking, if you haven't played it,
everybody knows who Sephiroth kills.
Okay, yeah. So when Sephiroth kills Ares, I would have to get my brother to come down to the controller and press X, like, as Cloud is, like, trying to kill, and just to initiate the animation so I didn't have to see it. Because I would run upstairs, and then my brother would be like, it's done. I'm like, okay. And I come back down. I'm like, yeah. And then I actually beat that entire game. Like, I've done everything there is to do in this game. I've beaten all the secret weapons and everything. But up until about 2 years ago, I never actually beat the game. Because one day, I was going through, like, Final Fantasy websites, and I clicked on this one site, and what it was a still of Sephiroth as he's getting killed at the end, with blood running down his face. And what it was just his, like, it's the crazy art direction, because it had these crazy wide eyes and his eyebrows were like up like this, and just blood running down his face on a black silhouette in the background. I gotten from that day. I had nightmares. I couldn't fucking play the game anymore. To the time where my
So you've never seen that image, or is it outside the game?
That's in the game.
It's in the game, but you never saw that image.
No, because that image was at during the ending of the game.
Okay, so you skipped the final FMV. You saw Aerith die.
Oh yeah, I got over that, but this was like a bigger hurdle for me because I had reoccurring nightmares. I couldn't fucking. It was one of those images that was kind of produced in my head up until 2 years ago, where I was just like, okay, well, I need to fucking do this, and I did it. I was like, it's not that bad.
And, yeah, it's funny when you do stuff like that. It's something that just horrified you.
I'm about to make Home Alone scary for you all. All right, so I was a little fucked, just living in a complex, nothing big. You remember when, I don't know if any of you guys did this, but when you were too young to know what, like, sexuality between a girl and a guy was, you would have boy-girl sleepovers. So innocent, like especially when I was like 10 or something. And this girl I would always sleep over was older, because she was straight up like a good family friend, and it was like, I'm not going to, like, chill with someone when my parents go out that isn't A, cool, and B, can't take care of me because I'm a little, like, 10-year-old, 11-year-old fuck. So we're hanging out there. She's like 13, I'm like 11. We're watching Home Alone. Our parents are out, meant to be out for like 3 hours. And we're watching it, and it's like, this movie's fucking hilarious. This ruined Home Alone for me. I cannot watch Home Alone without getting severe nightmares. Dude, we're watching this film, and there had been a string of robberies in the place. What had happened is, what they eventually found out, is one of the construction workers who had been installing new sliding glass doors in the back, they had somehow been able to fucking, like, knew the design of them, so it was just going to houses when he knew people were out, popping their doors open, fucking stealing all their shit, and then just popping them back in. And, like, one of this guy, George, that was a really close friend of my mom, described how he heard it happening in the middle of the night and came down with a baseball bat, and they left and left the fucking thing open, so he knew that they, like, somehow knew how to get in. Anyways, long story short, fucking, we're chilling there, watching Home Alone, and of course, what the fuck do we hear? This, like, savage rattling on the back fucking door. Boom, 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 boom. I'm like, what the fuck is that? She screams. I'm like a dude, so I, instead of screaming, I go, like, you know when you get so scared, like, us men especially, we always just close up? Like, are we thinking too hard about it, so I, like, went white-faced. It's like, boom, boom, and then I hear it, like, fucking, like, it's so clearly being, like, unrigged, but very forcefully. And to people out there, these fucking dudes who are robbing us probably laughing about it, but to me, all I can imagine is, like, the sinister fucking dude, like,
Joe Pesci.
And then, all the while, Macaulay Culkin's, like, there in the background, like, how do I stop these intruders? And it's, like, so playful, and I'm just like, I'm gonna die. Anyhow, long story short, she fucking went downstairs, flicked the lights on and off, it stopped. That's the fucking scariest part of it. Well, I was upstairs calling our parents, calling 911. Parents came home, all fucking good, it's fine. And then it was like 2 weeks later and they fucking arrested the guys. Because they kept robbing places. They tried to hit every place in this complex of like 106 complexes that were all there. So like, it was like the most intense thing, because you would go out for like Friday pizza night, and would have been normal Friday pizza night for 2 years. Suddenly it was the adults not drinking, the kids were playing, but the adults were just huddled, like dozens of them, like 40 of them just talking. Pretty much being like, who the fuck are we gonna kill for this? Like, and ruined Home Alone for me. I can't watch that shit. Wow. Yeah, and it's still really hard for me to be in, like, places with, like single-pane windows and shit, man.
Come on, Moth!
Yeah.
Let's go into the house.
For a final note, because we're talking about movies that frighten us, are there movies that have given you guys nightmares? Like, literally, I mean, have you had nightmares from movies?
Yeah, the first horror movie I watched was Poltergeist 2. And there's this, this old man who plays Kane in it, who's actually, I've run into him in other movies I've watched. He's, Beespeech is the man who plays Oedipus, the main character in Oedipus Rex.
Yep.
He's the guy who, like, speaks against his ruling.
He's in The Godfather, too.
Is he in The Godfather?
Yeah.
And he embodies, like, this ghost who's only just hinted at in the first Poltergeist, I think, and now he's, like, this, like, ephemeral being, and he just, oh, terrifying. He still terrifies people. I've seen him mention on the internet and stuff. You gotta watch videos. Just most.
So you would have nightmares?
Oh yeah, because that was the first one movie I saw.
So do you recall the nightmares?
No, I don't really have articulation.
It was definitely the only one that came in.
I saw it very
there was
young.
Some scene where
they flaunt.
Yeah,
they flaunt.
There was some like scene where they're sort of flashback where they're kids and they're in a sewer and they're like going through the sewer and he's there and some like green sludge or something.
That's
happened.
The scene I'm talking about.
Yeah, and I don't remember what plays out in that scene. Maybe you can refresh me, but
yeah.
In my dream it was just seeing that green sludge and that visual and I was like, I'm gonna die, and I was so happy it was a dream.
If I remember correctly, he drops like a balloon or something in the sewer, or like a pops or something, and then the fucking clown is in the sewer. Maybe this is a different scene.
No, you're right.
Yeah, and he's looking up at Billy or whatever.
Yeah, because they think he's outside, right?
Yeah, and he's offering him a balloon. He's like, do you want a balloon? And I can't remember, I can't do his voice, but he's like, they flaunt! They flaunt! And I'm just like, oh, shit! Like, that line just fucking...
And that guy, man, that smoosh is scary.
Too bad he turns into a giant spider.
Yeah, that's like
the
worst thing ever. Yeah.
But I was known when I was little for seeing horror movies way too young and not being shaken by them.
Yeah.
I got a severe nightmare, like really, really tough. Like,
really?
I still remember it, from Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
No.
Yeah.
That's not a horror movie.
I've said which movies have given you nightmares.
Wow. Okay.
And no horror movie has, to my that I can recall. But Who Framed Roger Rabbit, I had like a really intense nightmare. I was very young. But that movie scared the shit out of me. And I had
was
a nightmare.
It just that it just wasn't right when you were watching animation and humans living together?
I think the tone was really dark.
Yeah,
so it
has a weird tone.
But what freaked me out was, well, this is the nightmare. I still remember the nightmare. Mm. Like, it really fucked me. Is, were they weasels? The henchmen or whatever? The weasels were trying to pour the substance on me.
Yeah.
That
the
they
substance?
Try to pour.
Oh, the green acid stuff.
Yeah, which
thing,
if you pour it on a cartoon,
yeah.
they're no longer a cartoon or something.
Yeah.
It turns them into. Yeah. And so they were trying to pour the substance on me. And I remember like just waking up and like sweating and screaming. And I remember like my dad being there.
Yeah.
And the weirdest thing ever, this has never happened to me since, where I'm awake, but the nightmare hasn't ended.
Yeah.
Maybe it has something to do with being really young. So I could see, I have this weird memory of being in my dad's bed, like being in my parents' bedroom. I was that young, I went into the bedroom and stuff like that, and being able to see the weasels like on the wall.
Oh, okay.
And,
yeah,
I have this weird memory of seeing a weasel here and a weasel there, and they have this stuff, and I'm awake.
Yeah.
I've never forgotten that.
I will admit, at 21 years old, I was still lying in bed and a bit late. What if someone, like, I'll hear something and it'll be so nonchalant, I'll be like, what if someone was in my bedroom right now? And then you look, and it's like, is your curtains propped up in a certain way that it hasn't been for a while, and there's like a bar sticking out, and you'll like, it's all in your head, right? You make up some face looking at you, or someone perching in my window. And this happened to me like 2 nights ago, and I looked and I was like, shit! And then I was just like, wait. And I like flicked on my eyes, I was like, shit. And then I just went back to sleep. Like, doesn't affect me so much, but as a kid, shadows would play tricks on you, especially as a child. It was really hard. I had a tough time with that shit.
Mm.
I was a little bit of a pussy.
The cinema. Sure. Shadows playing tricks on us.
Yeah. And cinema plays to that, I feel. Yeah.
Shout out to Anthony Nicholas for mentioning our podcast.
Yeah, thanks, dude. I wasn't even a part of that one, but maybe you can mention this one, and then this is an advance thanks for mentioning it again.
Okay. Is that it? Is that our note to end on?
Yeah, okay, good stuff. Thanks for listening to Cinema Sleuths.
Yes.
We don't have a proper sign-off, but whatever.
Maybe we'll see you in a month or two. Whenever we feel
we should
like
be doing
next.
A Spielberg cast.
So long, farewell.
No, we have a song for our credits. You don't have to do that. You don't have to do that. We have a song for our credits.
So long.